Hello, everyone, and welcome to Open Observability Talks. I'm your host, Dotan Horvitz, and here at Open Observability Talks, we talk about anything DevOps, observability, and open source. So may the open source be with you. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Logs.io, the cloud-native observability platform. Logs.io takes the best-of-breed open source projects, such as Prometheus, OpenSearch, and Jaeger, and offers them as a unified observability platform built for scale. For those joining the live stream or on YouTube or Twitch, feel free to share questions or and comments on the chat. It definitely makes things more interesting for us here on the fireside chat. And let's move on to today's episode. Last episode, I discussed here the challenges of monitoring Kubernetes operationally, things such as configuration complexity, high churn rate, etc. Today, I'd like to talk about the challenge of monitoring your Kubernetes spend. With the current financial climate, cost reduction is the top of mind for everyone. IT is one of the biggest cost centers, and companies realize that they simply don't understand the cost of their Kubernetes workloads, or even have observability into basic units of cost. So we'll discuss this and the FinOps discipline for addressing this. And there's also a fascinating open source project, OpenCost, which aims to provide an open standard around that. And for this topic, I invited Matt Ray, who's the senior community manager for the open source OpenCost project. He's also a veteran in the open source and the DevOps communities, and also a fellow podcaster. Let me invite Matt to the stream. Hey, Matt, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Glad to be here. And thanks for taking this live stream so early in your time. You're based in Australia, so it's like 6 a.m. now, right?
Yeah. It's early, but, you know, monitoring never sleeps.
Yeah, I'm based in Tel Aviv and working a lot with US, especially West Coast. I know the challenges, but with Australia, it can be even more interesting. Yep. And also, as I mentioned, you're a co-host of your podcaster, and you're a co-host of the Software Defined Talk podcast.
Yes.
A small anecdote, by the way, last week I delivered talks in Belgium at FOSDEM and the Config Management Camp. And there I ran into your co-host, Michael Cote. Yep. So I hope he's with us today on the live stream. I did invite him personally. So maybe before we go into today's episode, do you want to tell us a bit about the show?
Sure. So Software Defined Talk is a podcast that I formed with two of my friends, Brandon Wichard and Michael Cote. Each of us has kind of a different background in the enterprise software industry. Cote is... he's currently in like kind of marketing, but he's got a background as an industry analyst. He worked for RedMonk and 451 Group. He also worked at Dell in mergers and acquisitions. So he's got kind of an interesting industry background. And then Brandon has been product manager for quite a while, different monitoring platforms. I think he worked at Boundary back in the day. he's worked at OpenID identity related startups, and we all work together at BMC, you know, one of the granddaddies of monitoring. And and my background is engineering and community and developer relations and kind of down that path. And so the three of us have different kind of viewpoints on how the industry works, and we've been podcasting for about 7 or 8 years now, and I think we hit episode 400 last week, so we're still going strong, and we all live in different sides of the planet, so it's fun to bring that in. Cote lives in Amsterdam, I live in Sydney, and Brandon's back in Austin, Texas.
That's amazing. This show has been around for this is the third year, but looking at more veteran shows such as yourselves, is definitely a lot to learn there. So great to see that. And hopefully my followers that like podcasts will definitely find interest. I highly recommend that. Yep. And let's talk about FinOps. That's a hot topic these days, as I mentioned in the opening, and with the potential recession. Many organizations these days are looking for what they're spending money on. And definitely cloud and infrastructure cost is typically the second highest line item after the salary cost, I think. So it's definitely top of mind for everyone. So before delving into the details, maybe let's start with level setting the basics. Can you help us figure out what FinOps is all about?
Yeah, sure. So FinOps is, there's the FinOps org, which is a foundation under the Linux Foundation. So, you know, they're open source, you know, without being, you know, code-based. It's a group that came together to kind of talk about the intersection between cloud finance and operations. You know, everybody is, not everybody, but most people are starting to run a lot of operations in the cloud, and it's a different cost model. You know, instead of going and buying a bunch of servers and, you know, waiting for them to be racked and eventually deploying your stuff 3 months later, you buy on demand. And so from the finance side of the house, that's a really different model. Instead of just buying a bunch of stuff and sitting it in your own data center, now you're renting by the hour, by the minute, by the second. And having to like bring that intersection of understanding how your costs are run and how they escalate, how they are managed, and what the development and operations need to do with your infrastructure, that's kind of where FinOps lives. And so nobody is, it's a new practice. I mean, I was, you know, talking to my kids the other day. You know, my son was like, oh, is AI going to put everybody out of business? And I was like, no, you keep moving forward. You know, the jobs of the future, you don't know about today. And like, if you told me when I was a kid that I would be working at an open source financial operations monitoring platform, I would just look at you cross-eyed. And so, you know, it's a new thing, but they put on their first conference in 2019. They put out a platform that, or a framework, if you will, that kind of explains what they consider how you think about these things, you know, what you need to consider, what principles you need to adopt, you know, things like bringing observability into your entire stack, bringing in all the stakeholders in. You know, it's not just engineers, it's not just finance, and you know, it's lots of different folks in between, and you know, how you track these things, how business, you know, it makes decisions. You know, are you going to spend more because you're selling more, or do you need to cut costs because you know, there's a belt tightening phase. What do you need to do? And FinOps gives you kind of a bunch of different you know, maturity phases and principles around it. It's a great framework. You know, if you haven't heard about this, and if you haven't started and you're in the cloud, you should start.
Yeah, I think first of all, definitely, and it's very easy. Just find it in finops.org. So very easy to find it online, and lots of useful resources. It is under the Linux Foundation, but as you said, it's not about code, rather than about, let's say, principles, yeah, and guidelines. And what I found, not specifically just in the FinOps Foundation, but in general in applying FinOps, we, for example, at Logs.io, where I work, we have a designated FinOps team. Mm-hmm. And when I try to explain to other people or to newcomers or others what it is about, I emphasize always that it's about maybe first and foremost about communication and about culture. That's for me the essence, about maybe breaking silos, obviously providing visibility and observability into the cost unit, but also creating this ongoing conversation about the mm-hmm. cloud costs, loop these costs into business decisions, and getting people to talk together, you know, bringing business and finance side of the house to talk with engineering or with product. In under normal circumstances, these organizations don't communicate so smoothly together. They also think differently, you know, engineering with the agile, with the quick, with the fast, with the break fast, fail fast, and mm-hmm. and finance with a very orderly, long, formal processes. So I think both sides of the house need to adjust to make this happen. So that's for me. And maybe one more point that I found useful is the core principles, like mm-hmm. the six core principles that I think are very good for those who are just starting their house, like as I mentioned, the collaboration is obviously one of them, and ownership is another very important thing that engineering can't just say, okay, we are about building the software, someone else to take care of the cost and the infrastructure elements and things like that. Now it's an integral part, accountability, ownership built into the, baked into the organization. Obviously the observability side of things that comes with it. You can't take ownership if you don't have very clear reporting and dashboarding and ways to see where things stand. So all of these, I think, principles are very, very useful, especially for those who are not, who are new to that. And even before getting into Kubernetes and things like that, which whoever uses SaaS and uses cloud, definitely highly, highly recommend.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've got a great O'Reilly book called, you know, Cloud FinOps. And second edition just came out like a week ago, 2 weeks ago. So if you haven't bought that book yet, you know, definitely check it out. It's by a bunch of the different authors. Or the authors, most of them work for the FinOps org at this point. And so, you know, I highly recommend that just to anybody who's getting into the space, you know, because you know you're going to learn something new.
and we mentioned several stakeholders involved. I mentioned like business and finance and engineering and product. I'm curious from your perspective, who are the core stakeholders that you see involved in these processes?
Well, so you know, to clarify, like my day job is I work for a Kubernetes cost management platform. So we are on the more technical end of the spectrum generally. You know, a lot of my coworkers have come from some of the larger, more established cloud financial platforms. You know, so you know, the space is it's not new. I mean, you know, as soon as Amazon started letting people, you know, do S3 and EC2, you know, bills started showing up and people started having conversations with finance. and so you know, the stakeholders over the years have, you know, it's you know, it's finance, it's, you know, CTOs, CFOs, it's engineering. Everyone's trying to work that out. Most of the people I talk to before I you know, changed roles within KubeCost to the OpenCost side of the house is I was working with our larger customers, you know, customers spending $1 million a month on AWS, you know, that sort of stuff. And mostly I was seeing the folks from the engineering side. You know, they had been told that they were spending too much and they needed to get a handle on what was going on. Or they were a large enterprise where lots of different teams were consuming cloud resources and they needed to sort out, you know, chargeback or showback. And you know, for those of you who are unfamiliar with large enterprises, a lot of times you get this bill and, you know, somebody has to take responsibility internally. And, you know, you might have different budgets. And so the nice version of it is showback, where you show who's responsible for, you know, hey, you know, team A is 60% of the usage and team B is 40%. And chargeback is when you actually have a established budget. It came from the days of enterprise software where you had all this, you know, compute internally and people had to share. And now that, you know, you have to share the bill for an external, of course, it's chargeback. And, you know, but with Kubernetes, a lot of it is such a black box to you know, even to engineering. Engineering generally doesn't pay close attention to their bills. They're not thinking, you know, oh, you know, when I'm call this function, it's going to cost, you know, 30 cents more a day. Nobody thinks that way. And so initially, just like the FinOps model talks about, you know, crawl, walk, run, we like to just bring in some observability, get people looking at what they're doing. And, you know, you don't have to, you don't have to have chargeback. You don't even have to, you know, it's showback. You're just showing people what they're using. And in some cases, we even call it shame back because, you know, you're like, did you really need, you know, a triple XL large to run Nginx? You know, probably not. But, you know, it is costing $1.30 an hour. So, you know, it's just getting people comfortable with the idea that everything you're doing costs money somewhere. And so, you know, we like to bring that cost monitoring into the conversation.
And how do you, beyond the tooling, I know that you're from the tooling side of the house, but looking at it from the end user perspective, or the agent within the organization trying to drive this awareness, how do you create awareness amongst engineers to cost and to spend?
usually someone outside of engineering has noticed the bill, right? Somebody has said, you know, hey, have you noticed that, you know, last month we spent $100,000 and this month we spent $150,000. Is this going to continue every month? You know, what's this growth look like? And so, you know, somebody who's responsible for that bill goes over to engineering management. Usually it's not like, you know, they call up the Nginx, the DevOps team and says, hey guys, you know, can you fix this? They start at the management layer and say, you know, this is, you know, can you justify this? They're not saying stop it, you know, because clearly the business is there to deliver some purpose. You know, IT is not just running servers because they like blinking lights. They're there to, you know, deliver value. And so, you know, that conversation gets held where, you know, can we bring in just a little bit of visibility? Can we see what's going on? You know, and maybe you could say, well, you know what, last month was Christmas, or, you know, Lunar New Year on our side of the planet. And, you know, there was a big rush of, you know, need for compute, you know, the big shopping season, and, you know, next month's going to be fine. And if it's not, we'll come back and revisit this. But it's usually coming from the business side. They've got concerns, you know, and if you're in a small startup, everybody's on the same team at the beginning, right? You know, you see that bill, you become aware of it. But really, as soon as you start to spend that money, somebody will probably wonder, like, are we spending too much? And, you know, what we want to do is start that conversation of like, look, here's how you're spending your money. And maybe it's just fine. But I can tell you, when I look at customers' bills, it's not fine. There's a lot of waste. We call it idle, right? With the cloud, there's kind of two models of consumption. There's usage based. So if you're doing S3, you know, well, S3's not a great example. If you're doing like Lambda, right, you pay by the usage. You pay every time you make a call, you pay some fraction of a cent.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you do a million calls in one day, it's this much. And if you do five calls the next day, it's less. And that's great. But the more common model is based on what you've allocated. You know, I say, I need to run 15 EC2 instances, and they're going to run 24/7 for 3 weeks. Well, I don't get to say, well, you know, they weren't really busy for part of that time, so I'm not going to pay the full price. Like, Amazon doesn't care. You have those machines allocated to you. You will pay the full price. And so if you're using them 100%, that's great for you. If you're using them 5%, that's great for Amazon, because they're gonna resell that capacity to someone else. But you know, you're paying either way. And so what we would look for is that unused cost. We want to optimize for usage. You know, if your usage is spiky, well, you know, sometimes you have to give yourself some headroom. If your usage is flat and you're paying, you know, a lot for hardly anything, well, you can optimize that. And that's just one form of optimization. There's lots.
Yeah, obviously. And you mentioned Amazon and in general, the cloud providers, they do provide, you know, first of all, you get the bill and you have some breakdown in the bill, and they have their own tools such as, AWS Cost Explorer, such as that. So what can you do with these, and where do they fall short in your perspective?
Right. So for most people, the Amazon bill, there's two bills. There's the one page bill, which nobody really likes that bill. I mean, you know, if you show it to a CEO, they're like, what does, you know, $1 million of EC2 mean? And there's no breakdown. And then the other bill is called the cost and usage report. And that is the very, 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 very fine-grained JSON report of everything that you do in EC2 that costs money. And Amazon drops it in an S3 bucket for you, and you can consume it with the tool of your choice. And, you know, all the different billing tools, you know, that read your bill, they're going to look in this, and this is where it has your discounts. you know, you might get savings plans or reserved instances. You might have something, discounted pricing that you've negotiated with Amazon. Well, I keep saying Amazon, but Azure, GCP, all the cloud providers do this. They have very, very fine, detailed, complicated bills that need to be processed, and those aren't human readable. And so that's the kind of the two ends of the spectrum for you as a consumer. And then Amazon provides tools like the Cost Explorer, and it says, like, look, your bill was, we'll just say $1 million, and as you drill into it, you could say, well, half of it was EC2, and then you drill into that, you can continue to go down and see, like, per instance, how much you were spending, which days, what you were paying for. You've got some VPCs, some storage, all those things, and you can see all the details, but it's not machine readable. It's not something that you can easily integrate on your side into your your visualization tool of choice, whether it's Grafana or Crystal Reports or Excel. You're going to want to consume that and put it into your financial engine or your monitoring engine. Both of them are endpoints that people care about. And they don't know anything about Kubernetes, right? And you probably don't. You don't want Amazon saying, hey, business team A did this and business team B did that. You're like, stay out of our business. So they don't know anything about what's happening inside the nodes. So they're like, when you get your EKS, your Amazon Kubernetes bill, it's EC2 with a management fee. You don't know anything more than that for which namespace was doing what, which deployments were costing you. That's completely opaque to you as an AWS customer from your bill aspect, and that's what we do.
So before getting into the tooling, I want to clarify. So FinOps started around the cloud costs in general, and you gave some good examples. Some people don't even understand when they have like reserved capacity, how well they utilize it, or when they do on demand and how the on demand performs, and the trade off things such as that. Lots to do there as well. But since we started touching about Kubernetes, and this is the topic of today, how is Kubernetes spend different from the cloud spend we've done so far?
Kubernetes spend for most customers just part of their bill. Most shops are not 100% Kubernetes. They're going to have some traditional workloads that are running on cloud instances. You got some Windows machines running in the cloud. That's generally not Kubernetes. You've got some S3, some databases. Beanstalk. Whatever it might be. That's not the Kubernetes side of the house. And so for us, we saw that most workloads were headed this direction. And not most, but a significant portion of the market. And the tooling did not really serve them. And the first edition of the Cloud FinOps book didn't really cover containers and Kubernetes really at all. There's a brief chapter on it, but it's brief. And, so we kind of saw this opportunity. And that's where, KubeCosta and later OpenCost, the open source component came from, is, we wanted to make sure that everyone could kind of get visibility into what's happening there. What's kind of different about it is it's just not a box that had been opened by most of the cloud tools at this point.
Yeah, but I do think at least when I try to analyze the way that that I did that in this organization, previous organization that I worked in, there are some different characteristics that I do see, like the difficulty to track when you're looking at the cloud costs and the shared resources, mm-hmm. allocating the spend. You gave some, maybe you alluded to that before, allocate spend to cost per customer, per team, per different environments, things such as that, or tracking the cost efficiency of your Kubernetes workload allocations over time across different aggregations. Can you say what you've been seeing with your customers?
Well, Kubernetes changes the game. For a lot of shops, moving to the cloud was lift and shift, right? They're like, hey, now we don't have to have a data center. And they just move their workloads, their fairly static, not very dynamic workloads, into the cloud. You know, they clean things up. And for some of them, they didn't get the savings they really expected in the cloud because they didn't really change their operations. They're just now in somebody else's data center. But if you've made the transition to more of a cloud native model, which is, that's essentially what Kubernetes is, where resources are allocated on demand. You've got some applications that are going to run for maybe a certain amount of time, or they're going to run wherever it's cheapest, and they don't have a lot of they are potentially ephemeral. They don't have a lot of state. They can be killed and rerun and moved around. When you start to get into that use case, billing becomes more complicated, but also you can save a lot more money. Kubernetes allows you to potentially condense the amount of compute you're using. So now instead of having one application per instance, you can say, well, I've got a cluster running there and let's deploy 100 applications to it, and the cluster can be resized at up or down, and those instances will move to different compute nodes as necessary to run. Just like virtualization potentially saved a lot of money by reducing the bare metal count, or condensing it into more powerful servers that cost less because you had fewer of them. Kubernetes allows us that option too. And from the billing side of things, that can be a nightmare because you've got your application today, it's running on node one, and Kubernetes decided that it wanted to move it over to node two, to node three, to node four. It killed some instances, redeployed it. You deployed a hot patch, it got put on node seven. That application is just running all over the cloud, all over what you're paying for. But when you get that bill, it just says 15 compute nodes, and you have no idea what did team A do? What did team B do? How much of that 15 machines was any of the particular team? And so that change in characteristics, it makes things a little more exciting. But potentially there's savings because you can look at it and say, well, we're paying for 15 nodes. But looking at the compute, the idle across the cluster, well, we never passed the 20% usage. Maybe we don't need 15 nodes in our cluster. Maybe we can get by with 10. And that's an opportunity for savings. Or we look at that and say, hey, our Kubernetes cluster has been up for 3 months. We've been running 15 nodes. We could reduce the size of it, or we could call up Amazon and negotiate reserved instances. Hey, we're gonna go ahead and pay for 10 nodes a month at a 50% discount for the next year. And that you can get deals like that because Amazon likes to know that you've paid up front and you like to save money. And your workloads, they might be really dynamic, but the base infrastructure they're running on is statically priced. And so that's comforting on the financial side of things. When things become more predictable, even if on top of it, on top of your Kubernetes, it's, you're deploying, 30 times a day, that's fine. As long as the EC2 nodes just stay there and get charged the same amount.
that's from the infrastructure, but still, when trying to create this accountability that we talked about before, and you need to attribute this attribution model per team or per customer or per environment, then the fact that the deployments and namespaces and so on are not really isolated and they actually share the underlying resources. You mentioned nodes. We can also mention the persistent volumes, the load balancers, and so on. Then the ability to make this attribution and then make the forecasting, the capacity planning, and also negotiating based on where you expect the business to grow in the different teams and the different product lines and so on becomes maybe a bit more more challenging. Let's put it this way.
For sure, especially in bigger enterprises.
Remember that some of this is justified from business perspective. Like if it's a spike in incoming requests for Rihanna's Super Bowl halftime performance this week, and you're in the business of the media, then it's expected. The spike is tightly related to what you deliver to your customers, the value, and hopefully you know how to monetize, or this is the top line KPIs. It's fine. So it's different when the cost spikes because of a legitimate business need that arises.
Right.
Unlike cost spikes that are just bad utilization, or someone just left the EC2 testing or machine learning model running, or something.
Even malicious instances, right? When you see a cost spike in a namespace, and you're like, why is, you know, what's going on over there? You know, and we've definitely helped customers find, you know, unsecured instances or applications that have been, you know, they start mining Bitcoin, and you're like, why did this cost you $100 over the weekend when it was, you know, a dev instance that wasn't supposed to be doing anything? And that happens too. It's weird to think of you know, the finance as a intrusion detection, but there you go.
Yeah, it proved more than once. That's definitely one of the common stories that people discovered Bitcoin mining after employing simple FinOps monitoring. So let's talk. I think we talked about all these vendors, and one of the challenges is also that they speak a slightly different language. It's not there is a way that you can also compare your AWS to Azure to GCP or to other bills, because there is no sort of common way of communicating, which for me was the way for me to explain to others about the maybe the most basic value proposition of open cost. So let's move on to Open Cost. This is the new open source project, the new kid on the block in the FinOps, in the cloud native space for sure. That recently, by the way, been accepted to the CNCF sandbox. So a big congratulations to you and the team there.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about what Open Cost is about?
Sure. So KubeCost, KubeCost started, I guess, about 4 years ago now. And the two founders had come from Google. They did some other work before starting KubeCost, but they were already well familiar with the open source space, and started KubeCost as the KubeCost cost model as an open source project, and then added additional value on top of it. But the intention was like, let's get this out there as the standard for Kubernetes cost monitoring. They started it, and COVID happened, kind of disrupted a lot of plans. But in June of last year, 2022, we announced that the CNCF had elevated the KubeCost cost model to a sandbox project, and they renamed it OpenCost. You know, one of the things you're not allowed to do in CNCF land is have the company with the same name as the project. You got to give up your trademarks and stuff, which is good. And so in addition to the code base, they've been working with other, other vendors, other individuals, other end users on writing a specification for what it means to monitor Kubernetes for cost. You know, how you identify different types of usage, whether it's idle or allocated. And so there's both a specification, the OpenCost specification V1 that, talks about allocation monitoring. And that's the first pass of OpenCost is what it does is it goes and looks at the cloud API. So it says to AWS, you have 4 EC2 instances running, and how much do they cost per hour? And the API just says, list price is this, and it takes that, and then it compares that to your Kubernetes usage. It says, well, we've got 5 namespaces, and we've got this many instances. These are our workloads, or pods, or containers, and it lets you slice and dice that. So you break down those EC2 instances by all of those Kubernetes primitives, and that's essentially what you get with OpenCost today. There's a UI that lets you explore this. The data is It's stored in Prometheus. So, you know, if you have a Prometheus compatible tool, we could, you know, put it in a different backend if you want. The folks over at Grafana are storing it in Mimir. You know, people use Thanos, Cortex, Victoria Metrics, you know, you name it. Somebody's put it in a different Prometheus compatible backend. But OpenCost is, you know, it's a CNCF project, so it's Apache license. The goal for us with OpenCost is just make it the, you know, ubiquitous default monitoring stack for, you know, cost. So as soon as you spin up a cluster and a Kubernetes cluster in any public cloud, you just throw an OpenCost on it to keep an eye on it. And, you know, then put it on the dashboard of your choice. And so that's what we're doing with OpenCost.
And who is the today essentially the it supports both on-prem environments and also cloud managed Kubernetes. Can you mention who is currently?
So because this was the engine of KubeCost, you know, they it already came it came, you know, working out of the box with AWS, GCP, and Azure. There is support for on-prem pricing. So you can upload or provide through a config map a default pricing. So you can say, hey, in my data center, we charge $1 for, you know, we charge $1 per hour per core, and we charge $2 per hour for RAM. You know, some nice simple pricing. And that's what I do in my home instances is like, I don't have fractional cents. I just want to see nice round numbers, you know, for my home usage. But it lets you, you know, set that pricing. There's support for, you know, more fine grained pricing. You can charge on GPUs, you know, because you may be, you know, consuming GPUs for, you know, AI or whatever. And so that's in there too. So that's what it shipped with back in June. And then the open source community has started adding other sorts of platforms. So we've got some patches in for Scaleway. You know, a European provider. We've got some Aliyun, you know, Alibaba's public cloud. That's in there. There, you know, there've been conversations with some other providers. We've got a document for how to you know, get started. We've got a very friendly Slack channel over in the CNCF Slack. So, you know, come ask questions. I'm happy to help you add your public cloud. And it's not that hard because we're not digesting the bill. You know, so I mentioned the cost and usage report as this, you know, multi gigabyte JSON file. Every vendor does it differently. Those files come out, they don't come out in real time. So that's one of the weird things about cloud billing is, you know, you have your on-demand costs. You're like, you look at it when you kick off your EC2 instance and says, you know, 15 cents an hour. And you're like, okay. And then maybe 48 hours later, Amazon says, well, you know, you did have some discount savings. You had a couple of credits. You had the reserved instances. It was actually only, you know, 7 cents an hour. And, you know, that might change how you look at things. And so OpenCost, that is a lot of complexity. You know, going and doing that reconciliation, parsing that bill on demand, you know, finding the data in there. OpenCost doesn't do that yet. And, you know, that's a... I can tell you from the KubeCost engineering side of the house, that's a lot of work. Most people don't, you know, from the OpenCost side of the things, most people don't seem to miss that. You know, we're really just looking at like, how much is this generally costing me? And, you know, the actual numbers are less important than the direction.
So let's make sure that our listeners understand. So essentially, it's not the actual bill that factors in all the credits and the discounts and thing. It's sort of a relatively static mapping.
It's
of
the on-demand pricing,
whether from the managed cloud provider or if you map it yourself for your on-prem.
Yeah, yeah.
So the math on top of that, right?
Right, right. It does not parse the final bill. It's going with the list price, and you know the list price for people like me. I pay list price. You know, I just run some instances on my own, and you know, I don't have an Amazon salesperson. So a lot of small medium businesses are not in any sort of negotiation. But even on places like Google with their continued usage discounts, you know, that would show up later. But that shows up like days or even weeks after you've spent the money. So you know they're kind of retrofitting your bill afterwards. OpenCost doesn't do that. OpenCost is really
you have a looking roadmap, at, by the way.
It's a large engineering effort that at this point we're still looking at other cost sources. So right now OpenCost provides what's allocated for your Kubernetes. So the instances, storage and networking, we're giving you that cost just based off of your deployed Kubernetes cluster. Right now we're actually headed towards the direction of out of cluster costs. So you've got a remote database, a database as a service that you're integrating with. Kubernetes doesn't actually know anything about that. But if you want to incorporate that bill, if you want to see that with OpenCost, that's what we're headed towards, is bringing in external asset costs. So object storage, S3, RDS, monitoring, you want to see how much Datadog costs you, how much logs.io costs you, bring it back to your workloads. Well, that's where we're headed, which is actually different from what KubeCost does. So we're kind of diverging. Because open source is usually about people scratching their itches. And the itch that most of our users have is, I have other costs that I want to bring in. People are definitely concerned about, their final bills. And, to send some business to KubeCost, KubeCost is free. It's just not open source. So KubeCost is free for single clusters. And gives you 14 days of storage, so you can deploy all the KubeCost you want, and it's free until you want to do like federated views and more storage and stuff like that. But maybe someday they will open source their build processing engine, but that is a enterprise beast of its own. On a different podcast, I heard an interview with the product manager for Amazon's billing engine. And he said that he's pretty confident that the Amazon billing engine is the largest non-government billing, non-government software project in the world. You think about how much compute is, how big AWS is, and everyone is running their workloads on AWS, and they're generating hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of metrics per second. Per customer. And they've got millions of customers, and all that data has to be stored, processed, and sent to billing, in a timely manner. And so, they are a substantial piece of AWS's infrastructure, is running their own internal billing engine for everybody who's on there. Bills are very, very, very complicated.
Yeah, I can tell you, my company is on the larger end of the medium size, let's say, and from what I see, the small enterprises definitely the all these packaging and all these crediting math can definitely make move the needle and change entirely the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And you have your dedicated person, whether you're an ISV or a medium size or enterprise. But so I'm just wondering, but you're saying that the pain is less from the community, at least the demand comes more on the PaaS side of things, like platform pieces that they incorporate, whether for data or others. Are there any other items on the roadmap for open cost project?
One of our goals with OpenCost is to move out of the CNCF sandbox. So, it's been open source for, I guess, about 6 months now. We're trying to build up our community, get external contributors, more people active besides, KubeCost employees. Last week, we announced Grafana Labs is now a contributor. They are deploying it on thousands of clusters. I don't know if that was their number, but I've heard the number of, you know, thousands of Kubernetes clusters thrown around, some of them very dynamic. And so they just deploy OpenCost onto everything, just as, you know, a monitoring agent to get visibility into all the costs, and they're pumping it into Mimir, which is, you know, their storage backend. Their use case is, they want everything on dashboards, of course. And, so they've shown up, started contributing, making OpenCost more efficient. Part of the roadmap is, you know, what sort of stuff is appealing to those sorts of shops. They brought some things. We've had, folks from other cloud vendors shown up. They want to have, you know, better support for their clouds. That's always on the roadmap. OpenCost is slowly diverging from KubeCost. You know, they're different, you know, use cases. And so part of the roadmap will be things like, taking these open source contributions, getting our own release cadence. And as we have more external contributors, more, you know, different documentation, we can move up the CNCF ladder, graduate out of being a sandbox to an incubating project. And part of that is just having more external folks involved. It's still early days, but we're having, a good healthy share of contributions from outside. OpenTelemetry is something that has popped up. There's some open issues features for that. People would like to see OpenCost implement that. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, OpenCost can do faster than KubeCost, because we're a much smaller, more efficient project. We need more community folks to get involved.
That's amazing. And glad to hear that you have some more people outside of KubeCost. So it's KubeCost people, but now also Grafana Lab people, any other major figures that are involved in terms of entities that got into the project?
So when we launched OpenCost, I mentioned it wasn't just KubeCost, open sourcing something. We had the specification. We had folks from Adobe, Armory, AWS, DTIQ, Google, New Relic, SUSE, Pixie, Red Hat. So those folks were all involved with the specification. And so, OpenCost is both a specification and a project. And so some of those shops will be taking the specification and releasing their own implementations. And so, part of that is... eventually, we'll need to form like an acceptance criteria framework, looks at your implementation, ensures that you are implementing the API. It's got all of those, scaffolding needs to happen. some of it's in place, some of it's in progress, and different. And today, like as we're working on the external allocation costs, their different contributors are getting involved, which is great to see.
And it's already, you mentioned that it's a young project, but still beyond KubeCost, it is implemented in others, I think in EKS. Absolutely. And others, right? So let's...
Yeah. We there are folks, showing up, lots of questions in the Slack channel. Grafana is one of the largest, public deployments. It fit their model very well. I'm hoping to get more names to publish. We've got a couple of partners who have added OpenCost APIs to their products. So I think Vantage is one of them. Drawing blanks right now, but look to see more open cost compatible API endpoints out there, especially in a lot of these Kubernetes total platforms where they're like, hey, we provide a dashboard to give you everything. Well, they'll put the open cost APIs on there so you can pull your financial data out of them. Whether it's, actually provided by open cost, the project, who knows? But that's the great thing about being a specification is you're driving a standard.
Exactly, and I think you mentioned OpenTelemetry. It's a great role model to follow. And if we can also converge and do something between the projects, it's definitely going to be a force multiplier. Before we wrap up the main part of the show, can you share, you mentioned briefly before some of them, but how can people join the community conversation, learn more, and get involved?
Right. So, the CNCF runs a Slack. So if you're a member of the CNCF Slack, join us over on the OpenCast channel. OpenCast.io is the website. GitHub.com/OpenCast is where the project, the website, the Helm chart, those are currently there. We have a calendar where every 2 weeks, every fortnight, we have a working group, which we kind of gather to talk about. We have an agenda, like what we're working on, what we need help with, what people would like to see. Some people show up and they just want to talk about their issue, and some people say, hey, let's start this external asset working group. So we're going to have a group kicking off a new specification and an example project. Those are about to kick off. So if you'd like to see external asset costs get added to OpenCost, join up. I think we're going to implement S3 as the example. But once we're done, we'll have a specification and documentation and a working example. So you can add whatever it might be that you'd like tracked in your cost monitoring, and then tie it back to your Kubernetes usage. That's what we're doing over in OpenCost.
Amazing. And then just a note for the listeners, if you're not a member, an official member of CNCF, you don't need to pay anything. No. The Slack channel for CNCF is open for everyone. You can just open your user there. And once there, you have all the channels in the world for all the projects, one of which is OpenCost, just hash OpenCost, and you'll be there in the conversation. But don't think that you need to be some sort of formal member or something.
No,
open for everyone.
And you should also join the FinOps organization. So FinOps org, they have their own Slack. There's not an OpenCost channel, but there's a lot of channels for different clouds, different tool sets. They're working groups for things like open billing. There's a Kubernetes and containers working group that obviously we're active in. OpenCost is the only FinOps certified project and CNCF project. So we are the intersection of those two worlds. And so definitely join either or both Slacks, and I'll see you there.
Yeah, sibling organizations under the Linux Foundation.
Yes.
Great. That was fascinating. And with that, I'd like to wrap up this part. And with the few minutes that we have left to cover some interesting bits and some breaking news. And very happy for you to stick around with me for these parts. You'll probably have some interesting insights, especially with your perspective and familiarity. The first one I wanted to share actually is something that I have been working on recently. I call it the Metrics Essentials Trilogy. Three articles that are meant to cover a lot of the common topics that I keep on encountering with users, with community members, with customers, and others. So it's I called it the Phantom Metrics, the Expensive Metrics, and the Unreadable Metrics. Phantom metrics is why your monitoring dashboard may be lying to you, a bit of the basics of how it works and what to expect of it, and where the monitoring will not show you exactly where in real time happens, and to take it with a relevant perspective. The expensive metrics is maybe somewhat tied to what we talked about today, about why your monitoring data and bill may get out of hand and associated costs with it. Like cardinality problem and other that. And the last one is about maybe some guide to effective dashboard design for DevOps type monitoring. So you're more than welcome to check it out. It's on Medium, and very happy to, some of that, by the way, ties back to topics that we've covered on this show, like with Ben Ziegelman about cost of monitoring and others. So definitely, if you follow this show, it will resonate. But I think it's a good summary. And do share some feedback. Glad to make it a starting point for a broader discussion. The next one is a CNCF blog about what's new in Prometheus ecosystem. Things such as the agent mode, native histograms, newly added service discovery mechanisms, the Prom Lens project that's been contributed to Prometheus, and much more. So it offers a good rundown list, and I highly recommend you check it out. I highly recommend checking out the episode we had here on the show recently with Julien Pivotto, which gives much more in depth. But this blog on the CNCF blog is definitely worthwhile checking out. Another thing we mentioned here before about OpenTelemetry. So I saw on the CNCF blog a very interesting post about migrating from OpenTracing to OpenTelemetry. For those who are not familiar, OpenTracing is a deprecated standard API specification that existed before and was then merged into OpenTelemetry together with OpenCensus and some other pieces. So many older implementations that used to run on OpenTracing now needed to migrate to OpenTelemetry. This was a very good walkthrough on what you need to in order to do that in a pragmatic way. Matt, have you had a chance to do some sort of a migration such as that, or play around with that?
Not yet, but I already had that tab open, so I'm definitely going to read that article.
Yeah, it's a good one, and it used to have a shim that made it very easy, but then again, shielded from the real migration work that needs to be done. So I definitely advise not to take the shim path. I think even the shim is already sunsetted and not supported anymore. It's important to understand it's been it diverged, it expanded far beyond OpenTracing. I mean, OpenTelemetry project API specification. So definitely worthwhile doing a deep migration path rather than the shallow one. So it's a good coverage on that. And also some CNCF project updates in addition to the good news around OpenCost project. We had some good news end of year about some projects. Like, I think the most prominent ones were Argo and Flux that have graduated from the CNCF incubation. So they're now in the graduated state, and some others. Next month, on the episode here, I will have Chris, CRA, as most of them know them, the CTO of the CNCF, will be here with me on the show, and we'll definitely be talking about the changes, the project landscape, and some of his predictions. So do join us on next month's episode. I promise it'd be interesting. He's an interesting guy. Yep. Matt, anything else that you found interesting this week or in the past month?
I just wanted to point out OpenCost. We're going to be at the Southern California Linux Expo next month. So if you are in the Southern California area, definitely show up at the conference. It's North America's largest open source community conference.
Scale 20X, right?
Yes, Scale 20X. I'll be giving a talk, and we'll be the OpenCost will be sharing a booth with KubeCost. And so hopefully I'll have some stickers there if you show up. And of course, I look forward to seeing everyone at KubeCon EU if you can make that.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be there. So looking forward to meeting you finally in person, Matt.
It's a long haul from Sydney, but I'll be there.
Amsterdam.
We'll have a
do check it out. And by the way, there are lots of co-located events on the first day. It's been reshuffled on the CNCF did some bit of organization there because it got a bit out of hand with all the colos. So now it's consolidated. For example, all the Prometheus Day and the OTEL Day and others now are consolidated to one Open Observability Day. Not to do with Open Observability Talks here at the show, but definitely touching upon the same topics. So it makes it easier, just one day of all the colos together. Highly recommended also to check out the relevant colos. Look forward to seeing you, Matt, and all the others. They're highly recommended.
That's great.
So thank you very much, Matt. How can people reach out to you after the show?
So if you're not in Slack, if you want to get a hold of me via email, I'm Matt Ray at kubecost.com. I'm on LinkedIn and Mastodon. I kind of stopped using Twitter, but I'm Matt Ray and those places. So I'm usually pretty easy to find, Matt Ray on GitHub. I look forward to catching up with folks.
Amazing. So thank you very much, Matt, for joining me on this early time there, Australia time. It was a fascinating talk. And thank you, of course, all the listeners who joined us today on this episode. All the episode, as always, are made available on all the favorite podcast apps or on YouTube. So do check them out. And if you are listening to this show, to this episode on demand, then do know that we stream the episodes live on Twitch and YouTube. So just find all the details on openobservability.io or follow us on Twitter at openobserve for updates on the next live streams and to share your comments, suggestions, news bits, or anything else. And if you have something specific that you want to talk about on the show, that you think that you're a subject matter expert on these relevant topics, do feel free to submit a talk proposal on openobservability.io. I'm Dotan Horvitz. Thank you very much for listening and see you on next month's episode.